as anyone else I've left out, forgive me. Ah, Christine. We're just a little bit late. Not too bad, though. We've got a bit of a hectic week ahead of us. So let's see how we can fulfill our mandate. Special word of welcome to Craig's governor. We heard that she had injured herself, so it's good to see her up and about. The purpose of this morning's meeting is to receive a presentation from the South African Human Rights Commission on their annual report. I take it that, Mr. CEO, you will be leading us in that? Okay.
Thanks very much, Chair. And just to quickly introduce the Commission's team. On the left-hand side, Commissioner Mokati, Commissioner Bai, our CEO, Kay Mohammed, our Parliamentary Officer, Judith Cohen, and she's accompanied by two staff members from the office in the Western Cape. We thank the committee on behalf of the Commission for this opportunity to present the Commission's annual report today. And the report will be gone through in detail by our CEO, who will look at the progress we've had in fulfilling our mandate and the challenges that we face. The key challenge for the Commission is the context of poverty and inequality. And the Commission has, since its inception, been concerned about this, and I think from the time of the poverty hearings, what has happened over the years is that there have been a number of lessons along with the successes that the Commission has had since its inception. The current situation that the Commission is faced with is how to take those lessons and use them to strengthen the institutions. So the institution since December 2010 has been going through an institutional transformation process, which Kay will detail. And I think that the issue for us of how do we use our mandate most effectively in terms of very limited resources, in terms of an extensive mandate, is one we've been applying our minds to and we've actually given effect to in particular ways over the last financial year. The key challenge is exacerbated in this country by the global context of the financial crisis, which has increased poverty, which has rightly been described as the biggest human rights violation. And it's also been one in the context where simultaneously there's been a bailing out of those who've caused the financial crisis to the tune of millions and billions. In times of such crisis, often the response is that those who are the most vulnerable bear the cost. And the Commission's role in terms of attempting to ensure that it defends the rights of those who are poorest in that particular context. The Commissioners have then looked at with this year with the fact that we now have five full-time commissioners, with Commissioner Bai joining us, and there's been an attempt to try to divide up the extensive workload amongst the commissioners, both the full-time and part-time commissioners. And so we've attempted to, for example, ensure that the chair, who is not present today, who's at another engagement, deals with asylum seekers, migration, counteracting xenophobia. I deal with basic services, access to information, and CEDAW. We also, there's UN treaty bodies. This will be gone through by KM in a lot of detail. Commissioner Mokati deals with children and basic education. Commissioner Malachi deals with disability and older persons. Commissioner Bai deals with housing, food, health care. Commissioner Love, who's a part-time commissioner, deals with environment, natural resources, rural development, and Commissioner Titus deals with human rights, law enforcement, and torture. What the commissioners have attempted to do is to give leadership in ensuring that the strategy that we undertake and give effect to is able to have the greatest possible impact. And in terms of what one of the motivations for a particular focus on children, which this year has been the report on child rights, on equity in child rights, which I think Commissioner McCarthy has brought copies of, is the impact on those who are most vulnerable. And if we were able to measure change, that would be the measure of change. The Commission, in terms of changing the way in which it's worked, has also looked at not just dealing with individual complaints, but just trying to identify what the generic right is. So, for example, on the issue of the individual toilets complaints, it has looked at the right to sanitation, and so it's held to account not just the two individual municipalities, but national government. And national government has undertaken through the Ministry of Monitoring and Evaluation an assessment of the status of the right to sanitation in every municipality across the country, which they will present to the committee, to the Commission, at the end of February. And so what we'll be looking at is whether they have an implementation plan and whether they have sufficient budget to be able to ensure that. The Commission's also looked at how, in terms of the complaints, when we look at things such as, for example, there's a complaint in the annual report on page 32, which deals with the mentally... deals with the fact that there are mentally ill prisoners and or state patients being held at the old Kimberley prison. And the Commission has been reliably informed that this is a national problem. The Commission next week hosts the 8th biannual NAMHI conference, the Network of African National Human Rights Institutions, which focuses on the rights of older persons and the persons with disabilities. It's, as a network, it will be looking also at how does it use its power, its collective power across the continent to have the greatest possible impact, not just on addressing the current violations, but the systemic problems that lead to the violations. And obviously, issues such as this one would be one that we'd be very concerned about. The Commission's also looked at, for example, in terms of its Section 5 committees, which commissioners are responsible for, matters such as the acid mine drainage and the responsibility and the accountability of both government and of business. And that's been broadened to the impact of mining. So it's an area that the Commission is now beginning to investigate and take forward the work it has done previously. So those are some of the critical things that I just wanted to flag before handing over to the CEO. I think the Commission's come here in the course of the financial year on many occasions, everything from the issue of xenophobia and the 2008 investigation to ensure that in 2010 the threat of xenophobic violence in FIFA 2010, post-FIFA 2010, was something that we engaged rigorously with government on the basis of the recommendations of our investigation. The Commission also did that in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity, where it engaged with government around the resolution that it had initially tabled in March this year, which it subsequently replaced with a far more progressive resolution in July, which has been hailed globally for its commitment to our constitutional promise in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity. We've come here also in relation to previously in the financial year on the issues such as trafficking, on the protection of information bill, on the protection of personal information bill, and on the choice on termination of pregnancy amendment bills, amongst others. The Commission has found the engagement in most instances a progressive and productive one, and we're beginning to see some shift, even though it's minor in relation to, and still needs much more in relation to PAIA and accountability by government, particularly at local government level. And we look forward to the committee's support in terms of ensuring that this report and the work of the committee and other reports are taken forward. Thanks very much, Chair. And I hand over now to Kay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honourable Members, Commissioners and colleagues. Thank you very much for this opportunity. The Chairperson, Advocate Bashwana, has asked me to please apologise for his absence. He's currently travelling at the moment. But if you do miss him during the course of today's presentation, there's a wonderful picture of him on page 3 of the annual report where he's got his wonderful smile. So, if you do miss him, you can turn to that page. The picture may not answer your questions, but we will certainly try to do so, Honourable Member. In terms of moving towards an effective and efficient institution, even though the Commission was asked to present our... my apologies. Commissioner McCarthy has just alerted me to the fact that I should also apologise on behalf of Commissioner Janet Love, who was supposed to be here, but unfortunately her mother's very ill and she's had to fly to London, I believe, to assist in that regard. So apologies on her behalf as well. The Portfolio Committee on Justice and Constitutional Development had actually asked us to present on our annual report, but because we are trying to be effective and efficient, we've also provided you with a copy of our first quarter plenary report for 2011-2012. So both those reports will be touched on today. I will focus very specifically on the annual report and then we'll turn our attention very briefly to the first quarter performance report for 2011-2012. The Deputy Chairperson has already provided you with introductory remarks, so I'll get straight to our overall performance for 2010-2011. For 2010-2011, the Commission has managed to achieve 67% of its strategic objectives. This is an increase of 15% from 2009-2010, when we had scored only 52%. And the primary reason for the increase in performance is related to our rethinking process, which was embarked upon towards the end of last year with the introduction of new commissioners who believed that we needed to critically reflect on the work of the Commission and to ask very honest and difficult questions about what we have done and what we have not achieved over the past a number of years. And this critical reflection has led to a strategic realignment process, with commissioners playing a leading role in pushing for the strategic realignment and the restructuring of the Commission. And this has led to a significant increase of 67%. Now, those targets, however, are still far from perfect. We need to get to 100%, and a plan has been put in place to ensure that we get to 100% by 2014-2015. You'll see the projected overall performance targets for the next few years. The minor jump from 67 to 73 in 2010-2011 to the current financial year is simply because of the impact of the restructuring process. So we expect a marginal jump for next year. But following that, we hope to reach 100% by 2014-2015, and this is in terms of our performance. The other bit of good news is that we received another clean audit with no matters of emphasis. However, the AG has raised concerns about our performance targets. He noted that only 30% of our targets were not time-bound. This was a key concern for us, which we are now addressing through the midterm strategic review. But generally, a very healthy picture of an institution based on the audit report as well as our performance report. As I indicated, we are not there yet, but we are well on our way to turning around the institution and moving towards 100% in the next 3 to 4 years. In terms of our overall analysis, we have identified a couple of administrative challenges which has resulted in our inability to achieve 100%. Firstly, there is a restructuring process which commenced in September 2010, and which is in the final stages at the moment. We should complete the restructuring process by March 2012. And this process has involved the realignment of human and financial resources to the strategic objectives that have been outlined in our new strategic plan. We, of course, always when we come to these meetings complain about our financial constraints. And again, this is something that hampers our ability to perform optimally. And then, of course, human resource constraints, which are related primarily to the restructuring process, but also relates to issues of lack of training and capacity on the part of colleagues who are currently in the institution. This is also being addressed. At a substantive level, we found that government has tended to comply very much with human rights obligations, but the compliance-driven approach has unfortunately resulted in a neglect of a substantive understanding and analysis of human rights issues. For example, Commissioner McCarthy led a report together with the United Nations Children's Fund, which was released in March this year, which indicated that the Department of Education had ensured that access to basic education had reached near universal levels. But the report also pointed out that the quality of education being provided to those primary school learners was not at the standards that it should be. So the tick box mentality, which ensures that compliance is achieved, is one step in the right direction, but there has to be a substantive analysis and understanding of the kind of human rights obligations that are articulated in the Constitution. Secondly, our seventh Economic and Social Rights Report points to the fact that there appears to be a conceptual misunderstanding on the part of government on economic and social rights. The interpretation and understanding of economic and social rights appears to be a significant challenge, and this is also indicated in our report. And then more recently, we've continued to have failure to comply with requests for information. The Constitution obliges us to produce an annual Section 184(3) report focusing on the progressive realization of economic and social rights. This year, I can tell you, only three departments have submitted responses to our requests for information. So we continue to struggle with the government departments and their cooperation in terms of the fulfilling our responsibilities to Parliament. In terms of the promotion of human rights, we over the past financial year had completed 497 community outreach interventions, several workshops and collaborative interventions with other Chapter 9 institutions. And we've also conducted more than training on PAIA for more than 1,000 public officials. So quite a lot of work that's been going into our advocacy program. In terms of the projects related to advocacy that's ongoing, there was a social cohesion intervention in Skillock in the northwest province in collaboration with the University of Witwatersrand. We held a reconciliation process between workers and former students at the University of Free State in relation to the rates hostel matter. And we've also annually hosted the National Information Officers Forum. Our protection mandate, which I will spend a little bit more time on, I know that at our last engagement with the Portfolio Committee, members of Parliament had specifically asked for an analysis of our legal complaints. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this. In terms of legal service statistics, we've handled 5,626 complaints, and you'll notice an interesting shift in the type of complaints that we now deal with. Equality has always been the number one complaint, but that was usually followed by arrested, detained, and accused persons and labor. This has now been replaced. Number two is human dignity, which is an interesting change. It's primarily related to the fact that we have also begun to analyze the types of complaints that we receive more thoroughly than we have in the past, and this is why we find the shift. We've also litigated 24 matters in the equality court. In terms of the legal services projects that we've embarked upon during the course of the last financial year and continuing in this financial year, is the revision of our complaints handling manual. We've just adopted the new complaints handling manual, which sets out very clearly and specifically how complaints should be dealt with. We've also been providing training for legal personnel and have partnered with a number of law firms who provided this training free of charge, together with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who has provided us with some funding for training for our legal personnel. So these are some of the ongoing projects that are taking place. In terms of specific statistics, you'll see that the top five types of complaints received, as I indicated earlier, is equality, human dignity, just administrative action, arrested, detained, and accused persons, and labor relations. In the next financial year, you will most likely see labor relations and arrested, detained, and accused persons moving out of the top five complaints. Unfortunately, colleagues in our provincial offices have, to a large extent, been accepting labor matters as well as prisoner complaints, but those matters are now being referred quite correctly to the CCMA and to the Judicial Inspectorate. So those matters are falling off the our human rights radar. We're going to be focusing very specifically on equality, human dignity, and just administrative action. The number of resolved cases, which has been very disappointing, has only been 205 for the 2010-2011 financial year. This is primarily as a result of not only capacity challenges, but also we believe an issue related to a lack of training and skills in our provincial offices, and these matters are being addressed. When I make reference to our 2011-12 first quarter report, you'll see a dramatic change in the number of resolved cases. I can tell you that for the first quarter of the current financial year, we've already doubled the number of resolved cases that were dealt with an entire year during 2010-2011. So these are the number of resolved cases. One of the important matters that was finalized and is highlighted in the annual report is the University of Free State matter. This is a picture of the agreement being signed by one of the workers, and the agreement was brokered by the South African Human Rights Commission together with the workers and the former students at the University of Free State. So quite an important matter for us that we finalized during this financial year. To give you a sense of the complainants who lodge complaints with us, in terms of language, we note that the majority of the complainants are English speakers. There is an unknown category because people simply refuse to provide this information, but this is the kind of thing that's being tightened up at the moment so that this information is provided by complainants, of course followed by Afrikaans and then Xhosa. Interestingly, you'll also see from the stats for the first quarter of the 2011-2012, if you just were to do a comparative analysis, that the number of Afrikaans complainants has increased significantly for the 2011-2012 financial year. In terms of racial classification, the overwhelming majority of complainants are African, followed by coloureds and Indians, and of course, unknown again reflects those who refuse to provide information on their race to the commission. In terms of the mode of submission of complaints, and this is an important statistic, you'll notice that most of our complaints are submitted via post, fax, and email. Personal interviews, of course, are the one-on-one interviews. Field work reflects our colleagues who go out into the field and then who receive complaints that way, and then internally generated complaints are complaints that the Commission decides to launch on its own accord. Now, this is clearly a reflection of the fact that the Commission does not have the necessary reach into communities, and that most people find the Commission's offices inaccessible, even at the provincial level. And this is why I suspect they rely heavily on post-fax and emails to communicate with us. So we are paying serious attention to this anomaly, and we will be ensuring that there is greater outreach interventions into provincial areas and into rural communities in particular. In terms of monitoring human rights, two significant reports were produced, the 7th Economic and Social Rights Report, which I alluded to earlier on, as well as the Equity and Child Rights Report that was compiled together with UNICEF. And we have provided copies of the SHRC UNICEF report to members of parliament. In terms of some of the monitoring projects that are currently underway, an agreement was signed with the Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute to assist us with the economic and social rights reports. We have done a project focusing on equality court and looking at the effectiveness and efficiency. And then we've also revised our Section 184.3 protocols, which I made reference to earlier on as well. The Commissioners Program have been very active over the last financial year and have had a couple of noteworthy interventions, some of which the Deputy Chairperson had already alluded to, such as the sexual orientation matter involving the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, which was resolved fairly successfully. For December the 10th, International Human Rights Day, we also had a campaign focusing on the ratification of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, and these are just some of the noteworthy interventions that have taken place over the last financial year, which commissioners have specifically led during their tenure. Then we turn our attention to the 2010-2011 financial performance. Our acting CFO, Masa, is here to answer any specific questions around finance. But there was a deficit reported, which in itself is not necessarily a bad thing, given that the commission remains within the baseline allocation for the 2010-2011 period. The primary reason for the deficit was as a result of the depreciation of non-cash items as well as the disclosure of contingent liabilities. And I should point out when we look at financial challenges that we've had two major matters which remain unresolved but which we hope will be resolved by the end of this financial year. There is a certain amount of money owed to the Department of Public Works, but the reason for this is that they've simply failed to invoice us appropriately based on the offices that we rent through the Department of Public Works in the provinces in particular. So our acting CFO had in fact met with the CFO of the Department of Public Works 2 weeks ago, and the matter is currently being looked at, where we should be able to sort out the finance challenges relating to this matter. And then the ongoing issue with the Civil Society Advocacy Project, which was the EU-funded project, is in the process of being resolved. We've come to an agreement with the Institute for Democracy in Africa, IDASA, around the payment of the CSAP money that's owed to them. And we have also come to an agreement with the EU to ensure that the remainder of the money is returned to them. So these are really the only two key issues that are reflected in the annual report, but are in the process of now being resolved quite amicably. To give you a sense of our overall financial performance, you'll see that the personnel expenditure had increased from 2009-2010 to 2010-2011 from 46.8 million to 50 million, as well as the administrative costs, which had significantly decreased. And this was primarily due to the fact that we had shifted a lot of our admin money to actual human rights work, to the programs, which you'll notice from the increase with respect to professional services. In terms of land and buildings, we've ensured that we've renewed leases in the various provincial offices, and this has accounted for the increase from 2009-2010. And we've also provided you, just for information purposes, with the information relating to 2011-2012, which I will speak to a little later. The Auditor General's report, just to provide you with an overall analysis, as indicated, we've managed to achieve a clean audit with no matters of emphasis, and in our post-mortem of the audit, the Auditor General indicated that they received full and complete cooperation during the audit. So generally, a very good picture in terms of our finances and auditing requirements. But there were, of course, challenges identified, some material misstatements in the financial statements, which were subsequently corrected. There were issues around whether or not matters should be classified as provisions or contingent liabilities, and this resulted in the misstatements, which we subsequently corrected. As I indicated earlier on as well, 30% of our targets were not time-bound. They did not follow the SMART requirements, and we are now addressing that particular challenge during our midterm strategic review. And then there was 291,000 noted of irregular expenditure. Unfortunately, this was an oversight on the part of our administration and the secretariat, where no tax clearance certificate was requested by the supplier, and it was subsequently discovered after giving the supplier the job that he had no tax clearance certificate. So this matter has also been identified as one of the key challenges and the gaps in the audit report. But it wasn't found to be material, and hence we've achieved a clean audit with no matters of emphasis. Chairperson, with your permission, I'll quickly go through the first quarter performance report for 2011-2012, and then through you, Chair, we'll take some questions. An overview of the first quarter performance indicates that we are well on our way to achieving most of our targets. We've achieved 64% of our targets so far. 15% have not been achieved, primarily due to the restructuring, as well as the challenges related to budget and human resources indicated earlier. We've also managed to exceed 7% of our targets, and that relates primarily to the advocacy and outreach interventions that were planned for 2011-2012. Also wanted to focus a little bit on the promotion of access to information and our PAIA unit. There were a few late submissions from national departments, but we have found now that the overall compliance rate is 22 out of 42 departments who have complied with the PAIA provisions. It was initially 18, which has now increased to 22. Secondly, 28 out of the 284 municipalities submitted reports in terms of Section 32. So members of Parliament can clearly see that the compliance rate at both the national and provincial level have not been particularly good in terms of PAIA. And this is a consistent pattern since the legislation was adopted, and this is also reflected in one of the annexes to our report. There have, however, been some positive trends. The Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries posted fairly high request volumes, granting over 60% of requests received, and then all other national bodies granted full access in approximately 50% of requests received. And then just to give you a sense, as I indicated earlier on, of our legal matters that were dealt with during the first quarter, the first 3 months of 2011-2012, we've already finalized 571 matters compared to the 205 that were finalized in 2010-2011. And this is reflective of the fact that we've put a huge amount of resources and shifted human and financial resources to our legal services program. This is something which was clearly decided upon in our strategic review. And you'll notice for the next 3 years that we're focusing heavily on our legal services program. This, of course, means a rationalization of resources, and unfortunately it also implies that our promotion and monitoring mandate will not receive the same kind of resources that we are giving towards our legal services program. And there are specific reasons for that which are outlined in our strategic plan. Mainly, of course, we don't have the kind of resources to dedicate equally to all three of our strategic focus areas. So we are focusing for the next 3 years on investigations, and you can already see the kind of improvement that has taken place there. Then one of the key issues that were determined at the outset of the period under review is that commissioners have identified very specific strategic focus areas that they're going to be looking at for the next 3 years. You'll notice that the deputy chairperson, for example, is focusing on basic services, access to information. Commissioner Titus, who couldn't unfortunately be here with us today, has been working quite heavily on human rights and law enforcement. In fact, he hosted a workshop earlier this year with a number of members of the police, as well as those involved in law enforcement, focusing on human rights, as well as allegations of police brutality. Commissioner Love has focused very heavily on acid mine drainage in her Section 5 committee, and has been quite involved in environmental and natural resources. And then, of course, some of the other commissioners who are here who could possibly speak to their areas is Commissioner McCarthy on children and basic education, Commissioner Bai on housing, food and healthcare, and Commissioner Malachi, who unfortunately couldn't be here, will be focusing on disability and older persons. And as the Deputy Chair mentioned, we will be hosting a conference in Cape Town from the 19th to the 21st of October, focusing specifically on disability and older persons. All of the African national human rights institutions will be invited to that particular conference. Two more slides to go. This one just gives you an overview of our strategic plan for 2011 to 2014, which I've alluded to throughout the presentation. We note the financial constraints and the possible double dip recession and the limited resources that that government has available. We also acknowledge our broad mandate in terms of Section 184 of the Constitution, as well as international human rights law treaties and the Paris Principles. And following an in-depth analysis of all of these factors, together with a number of others, we've ensured that we will be focusing very heavily for the next 3 years on our legal services and protection mandate for 2011 to 2014. And already you can see the kinds of improvements that have been reflected in the first quarter reports for 2011-2012. And then lastly, just to give you an overview, this is something I showed members of Parliament during our very first presentation, and this is phase one of our realignment process. We've now in the middle of the medium-term restructuring, reporting, and implementation process. And then towards the end of this year, we'll be moving towards the monitoring and review process. So this is just phase one of a three-part realignment process that should conclude by 2014-2015. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Should we take questions? Yes. All right. Let's take questions on both the introductory remarks by Deputy Chair Briggs Govender and the CEO's presentation. Debbie Schaefer, John Jeffries, and Steve Swart. And Dean Smuts. In that order.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start off with a few and see where we go from there. First of all, I just want to ask, well done on the unqualified audit again. That's a good start. But what about, what kind of engagements have you had, if any, with the new office on institutions supporting democracy in Parliament? Then I would like to know your IT infrastructure. You have highlighted it in the last 2 financial years that you need to upgrade it, and I have major concern about that throughout the whole justice cluster. You know, I mean, the computers are so completely outdated. How far will that take you with your extra $4 million in 2011-2012? Will that then complete the process? If not, how long will it take? And surely that must be one of your number one priorities, to deliver services properly. On your contingent liabilities, can you please give us more details as to what these claims of 2. However many million billion rand against you and IDASA and the EU, the billion, 3.3 million and 2.4 million, and then just on your PIA, what is your strategy to deal with the lack of compliance of departments and municipalities and so on? It's really, really unacceptable that such a large percentage of people, of the institutions, are still refusing to comply with this act. And my one particular concern is regarding this Kakadu municipality that you, in your annual report, where they refuse to do it because they don't deal directly with the public. What kind of municipality doesn't deal directly with the public? And what have you done in regard to that complaint? Have you referred it somewhere for further action? What have you done? That is just completely unacceptable. And then just on your restructuring, obviously we all know how restructuring is very unsettling for staff. How have you managed to mitigate that negative effect of restructuring? And how has it affected your performance? Thanks.
Chair, your apologies for coming late, and I missed the Deputy Chair's input, so maybe some of the issues might have been covered by her, I don't know. But just very briefly, I'm generally happy with the presentation and the work that the Human Rights Commission is doing. So just that is a general point. But then specific questions, the vacancy rate is going up again, 14%. why, what's happening. It was lower last year. I can't find the page now to have the figures, but I think it has gone from 10 to back up to 14, where it had been the year before the 10% one. That's one. Number two, the issue of attendance. It would be useful to see attendance at meetings of commissioners. Can we get that please? Then your contingent liabilities. Maybe it was covered more. I don't know, but I really would like more detail. You've got claims against the Human Rights Commission by DASA, 2.4 million. Claims against the Human Rights Commission from the EU, unaccounted expenditure, 3.33 million. Litigation in the High Court, Roberts, half a million. An invoice in dispute with Public Works. You spoke about problems of not being invoiced, but this is like 2005, 2006, so it's 5 years ago. What's that all about? So can you give us more detail on that? Then the issue of, in your report, there was a table on page 48 on the implementation of treaties, which you didn't cover, or the CEO didn't cover in his presentation. I don't know if the deputy chair did, which sort of shows a rather alarming level of non-compliance. What are you doing about that? And in a sense, I know it's a sort of ongoing issue that comes up when you come here. And you would presumably have your own views on it, but it's a question of how are you using Parliament. So if there's a problem around fulfilling the international obligations, why don't you even tell us about it on the part of government? You put it in your annual report for everybody to see, fine, but I would have thought you would be having an item where you highlight concerns on that you want Parliament or you'd like Parliament's assistance with. That's still not happening. We get the reports, we're meant to then work out what to do with them. The on PAYA, the issue of the magistrates' courts. I'd want to know what your analysis is of the usage. I mean, so this would be, I suppose, specifically to the deputy chair. What the problems are with the magistrates' courts not being used to deal with PAYA disputes, and also linked to that is there are provisions in PAYA for penalisation. I don't have my PAYA Act in front of me, but if I think an information officer incorrectly refuses to give information, I think this can be subject to criminal sanction. Why are you not using that? Just basically those. And then the last point is, I mean, this is, Chair, as I understand it, part of the budget review process. It's the second time we've done it. We did it last year. It's where you come and ask for more money for specific matters. Apart from a general complaint of underfunding, which we know about, you don't target particular matters. So one would have to assume that everything is fine. It's a bit like Chair, the employment statistics, there's two levels of measuring employment, those who are unemployed, and I think the official figure is those who have stopped looking for work. And the problem with that figure is that they've presumably given up. They may still want work. Now, I don't know if the Human Rights Commission falls into that category, but I seem to remember that last year we were able to get you some more money, but it has to be money targeted for specific purposes. And you just haven't done that at all, so obviously we can't ask for any more money for you. Chair, I think those were the issues. If there's any more, come back. Thanks.
Okay. Steve Swart, please. Noting all these questions. CEO and commissioners.
Just thank you from my side. Also, well done on the clean audit. I just wanted, as far as the finances are concerned, just to get an indication on that whether the risk management officer has been appointed yet. That was the one issue that came out of that. And then in your slides today, there was a reference to a material misstatement on financial statements. Just explain that to us. The other questions about the 3.3 million have already been asked. If you could just respond to that. Then, in your current, in your cases, there's a reference to the matter that was in the papers about the 181 babies that died in the Eastern Cape. That was in April 2010. When do you expect to complete that inquiry? That obviously there's a concurrent inquest that will be held, but just from your perspective. Then on the cases, it's also quite interesting if you look at your stats on your legal stats, your page 115. Is there an explanation for the high number of cases in the Western Cape? It's 940. Current cases, 940, compared to like Gauteng, which is 330, KZN 47. Maybe you could just give an indication of that barrier. It's almost three times as high as other provinces. You also allude in general to the problem of government's attitude being compliance-driven as opposed to having a substantive understanding of government's human rights obligations. And just, again, the question arises as to how to address that. Firstly, when it comes to PIA, the questions around that, the issue of cooperation with the Chapter 9 institutions here at the unit in the Speaker's office. And is there any consideration? There was a very interesting article in the New York University Law Review in 2008 about the possibility of using structural interdicts to enforce socioeconomic rights in South Africa, and a very important role that the SA Human Rights Commission can play in that. And it's focused on South Africa. Maybe you haven't read it, but it's just your comments on the usage of using interdicts to enforce socioeconomic rights. The other issue that I also wanted to raise is the tying in with PIA, and you make reference to the Mail and Guardian case right at the end of the annual report. If I remember the judgment, there was almost a reference to a concern about a resilient culture of secrecy that exists in the state. Is that also something that is of a concern to you when you have non-compliance with PIA? And a question relating to, you also make reference to your submission on the Protection of State Information Bill. Have you had an opportunity to study the newest draft of the bill, and will you be making a further submission on that? Just for the time being, thank you for those, Chair.
For the time being, I mean, there are now so many questions that I'm not sure I should.
Do you want to hold?
Expand the list. No, only let me just small things,
okay.
Because otherwise we have to recover the same territory. But just, I'm impressed by the fact that you point out the limitations of the list ticking approach. I'm afraid the whole process of holding departments to account is suffering from the same. Limitation in general. And I agree with you that there's a conceptual misunderstanding, especially in respect of socioeconomic rights. If the education is fraught, it's no good saying all the children are in school. And my question, therefore, out of curiosity, is just how do you deal with that? I'm afraid I didn't see that seventh socioeconomic report. But what do you do? Do you then tackle the substance of the problem? Do you say in your report, but the education is no good, and then what? Then it's up to us, isn't it? Then it's up to Parliament to use that. Okay. I've got the nods. I've already got my answer. And I was just curious to know what the dignity complaints, which are now the second highest category, what they consist of. Very curious to hear what the effectiveness of the Equality Courts is, if you are ready with a reply. And then I think we're all looking at your PIA work because we are in the throes of the PPI. And thank you very much for this table at the back of the annual report. It's the first time I've seen it done like this, where you show us which are the government departments who did fulfill their Section 32 obligations. And again, I would just like to ask, I've got a feeling you don't have powers to follow up, but look at mineral resources. I'm on page 157 of the report. Look at mineral resources that had 607 requests for access and which turned down 593 of them. Again, is it Parliament that's supposed to follow up, I guess? And the only thing I don't understand in your tables is the C category there in the middle is supposed to indicate which provision of this Act, meaning PIA presumably, was relied on to refuse access in full or partially. Now, how does that work? I mean, you just give us the number 593 again, but you don't tell us which section of PIA the thing was refused under. If it's mineral resources, it must have been what? The section dealing with what? Economic secrets or trade secrets or whatever. But so I don't understand how that table of yours works. But the table is nice to have. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will start off by answering some of the questions, and I'm sure the commissioners will contribute and add to my responses, as well as perhaps my colleagues who are sitting around the table. If we start with the Honourable Schaefer's questions, the first question related to the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy and what engagements have we had with the Office. I'm actually glad you asked this. We attended 2 or 3 weeks ago a workshop which was hosted by OISD in Cape Town, and this was 1 year after OISD was actually launched. And at that workshop, the Commission was very critical of the work of the OISD in the sense that not a lot of the recommendations that were made 1 year ago had actually been implemented. Following that criticism of OISD, they in fact came to Johannesburg to meet with us, so with the commissioners and with myself, to engage further on our concerns around the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy and their, in some instances, inability to fulfill some of the key recommendations that were made 1 year ago. They provided some very good explanations for the reasons why they were unable to operate effectively, and they've also requested information from us in terms of how they can assist us for some of the outstanding legacy matters that the Commission has been dealing with. So it's an ongoing engagement. We've also recently been invited to a workshop that they are hosting on developing their strategic plan in about 2 weeks from now. So we will be attending that as well. Yes, Commissioner McCarthy also wants to add to that.
Thank you. The CEO is correctly reflected on this matter. I just want to add that we as the Human Rights Commission do have some concerns from the meeting that we had with the OISD. It's true that we expressed those concerns because a year down the line we had not had anything from this unit. But having met with them in Johannesburg at our offices, we do have concerns, and some of those concerns, I'll just deal with two. There were more than two, and just those two relate to the fact that we have now been told that there's going to be a retabling in Parliament of the report, of the Kada Asmal report. Now, some of the issues that were mentioned in that report, for instance, the absence of conditions of service for the commissioners, the issue of the amendments to the Human Rights Act, we understand are linked to the tabling of that report. Now, that's where our concern comes from, because we don't know. This report came out in 2007. We don't know how long it's going to take if this report is, for this report to be retabled in Parliament, and how long we will have to wait after that for some of these issues. And we feel very strongly that these are issues that can actually be dealt with outside of the retabling of the report in Parliament.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thanks for adding to that. The second question by Honourable Schaefer related to the IT infrastructure and the whether or not there are sufficient resources to ensure that IT is up and running effectively. What we have done, there's never enough money for IT, I'm afraid. But what we have done is to utilize some of the savings that we've made during the course of the year. And the savings are stem primarily from the vacancies, which I will address later on. And that money, we are allowed to transfer 8% of our salary budget to operations. So towards the end of 2010-2011, we, for example, purchased a number of new computers for provincial offices in particular, given that we are now moving to an electronic case management system as opposed to the manual system that's currently in place. So IT infrastructure is something we are continuously concerned about, but we have thus far been able to manage with the limited resources we have. We've adopted a sort of a dualist approach. There are usually two broad options. The one is to have everything in-house. The other option is to outsource everything. We've sort of found a nice medium between the two, where we have solid IT people at the institution, but have also outsourced some of our, for example, the email management of our email to an institution, to another company. So that's the way we've tried to find a balance. Sometimes it's easier or cheaper to outsource these services as opposed to having them in-house. But I could also perhaps, maybe Masa would be able to add to that as well in terms of the IT infrastructure. The third question related to contingent liabilities, the IDASA DPW money, and it was also asked, I think, by two other members of Parliament. These, I must indicate, are legacy issues that have been inherited by the new set of commissioners as well as the new secretariat. With the Department of Public Works matter, what happened in the past was that the Department of Public Works would negotiate contracts, lease agreements with various individuals, and would then ensure that we move into those premises. They would also in the past pay the full lease agreement amount, so that amount was devolved to them. Subsequently, the lease money was paid to the commission, and what then happened was we had to pay the difference between the old lease amount and the new lease amount. So for example, if we were paying 100 rand a month at the provincial office in Mpumalanga, DPW would be paying that full amount. Then if the lease was renewed and the lease would increase to 200 rand a month, we would have to pay the difference between the 200 and the 100. And this caused a huge amount of complications with the Department of Public Works. So the reason why we decided to meet with them is I've written to them on three occasions. I've written to the DDG responsible for this area. I've not received a single response. I then asked Masa to travel to Pretoria and to sit in with the CFO, who was very amenable to assisting us with this particular matter. And we hope to resolve this matter within the next couple of weeks. So the DPW issue is something that we've inherited and we're now trying to resolve. We have that money set aside, in fact, to pay them. So that's not an issue at all. It's just a matter of getting an invoice from them before we can actually pay. And that's what's outstanding from DPW's side. The second issue around the IDASA European Union funding, again, an inherited matter. A few years ago, the Human Rights Commission, the Public Protector, and the Commission on Gender Equality received donor funding from the EU. This donor funding was transferred into a bank account run by a unit called CSAP, with joint responsibility between these three institutions. Unfortunately, one of the challenges was that after work had been conducted by IDASA, we needed to pay them a total of 3.6 million for the work that's been completed, which means 1.2 million per institution. This money was supposed to be paid with the EU funding in a bank account that's still sitting with us. Unfortunately, the EU raised some queries about the way in which the agreement was signed. I'm told that the agreement with the EU, with IDASA rather, was concluded one day late, based on the timelines that were set by the EU. And because of this, they refused to pay IDASA the 3.6 million. Now we are forking out this money, the three institutions. We've met on a number of occasions. I've met with the CEOs and the CFOs of those respective institutions. We've met with the Deputy Minister of Finance, the Deputy Minister of Justice came to our offices. The chairperson has been engaged with a number of, with the EU ambassador and a number of other officials. So the matter is now in the process of being finalized. The reason why this was highlighted in the report by the AG was because we had listed this as a contingent liability, which was contingent upon a number of circumstances being fulfilled, and the AG has suggested that this should be actually identified as a provision. So this was the reason why there was a difference in opinion around the way in which the issues were recorded in our financial statements. But this was, of course, subsequently sorted out, and we have been engaging with IDASA. We had a meeting with them and with their attorneys, and we are meant to pay them our portion of the 3.6 million, which is 1.2 million, by the end of October, and we also have the money readily available to transfer to them. We are simply waiting for the agreement to be sent to us by IDASA's attorneys. So the matters are inherited. They are long outstanding matters, but they are very much in the process of being resolved, and hopefully by the next time we meet with the portfolio committee, these two matters would be taken off the list of issues and challenges that we are facing. The fourth question related to PAIA and the strategy to deal with the lack of compliance, and this is a very important matter, which I think some of the other members of parliament had also alluded to. Clearly, the Commission has a responsibility to highlight some of these issues, these challenges and concerns. But our ability to actually enforce the recommendations that we come up with, there are certainly limitations to them. This is why we bring the information to Parliament. And we rely on Parliament to assist us in ensuring enforcement and implementation of our recommendations. We were also hoping that the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy would be able to play this facilitative role, but clearly there are some challenges there, so we rely heavily on the Department, on the Portfolio Committee. Maybe what we have not done, and I take Honourable John Jeffrey's point, maybe what we have not done is to highlight specific instances that Parliament needs to engage with various departments on. Having said that, we have had, the chairperson has had a meeting with the deputy speaker to take up a couple of outstanding matters. We've also had an engagement with the state president around this, around some of these outstanding matters, particularly as it pertains to the non-ratification of various international instruments. And we've also written to various ministers, such as the Minister of Justice, as well as the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, around non-compliance. And this is broadly, this is beyond PAIA. But we do rely heavily on Parliament for, and the Portfolio Committee in particular, for your assistance. I was very happy to note, when I looked through Parliament's report, particularly the report of this Portfolio Committee for the last financial year, that you made specific recommendations following our presentation to you, and we're very grateful for that, one of which was around the increase in finances and our budget, and so we are extremely grateful to you for that. But I do think that maybe we need to be a bit more focused and strategic in how we bring issues to you so that you are able to take that up, as opposed to tabling a full report with lots of information which you then have to sift through. Maybe we need to be a bit more strategic there. And then the last question from Honourable Schaefer related to the restructuring process and what has been... Kakadu Municipality. I unfortunately don't have the details around that. What I can do is to provide you with information as soon as I've spoken to the person who deals with PAIA at head office. But unfortunately, I don't have the information for you around that specifically. My apologies. The other issue was the restructuring and how have we mitigated the negative effects. What we have done is to have extensive consultations with all of our colleagues. We are a very unionized organization, so we've met extensively with the union, with senior managers and non-union staff. But we've also gone beyond that. We have provided psychosocial services. We've gotten a company, an independent organization. to come in and provide both psychological assistance and services to our staff, as well as financial assistance, or financial counseling rather. So this is something which is ongoing and which is provided to staff at any time. They have a certain number of hours that they can have with, one-on-one with a psychologist or a counselor. So this has just been one of the ways in which we've mitigated. Communication, of course, is also key. I have regular staff meetings, meetings with these various constituencies, as well as communiques that are distributed to all staff. But it has been, as you correctly state, a fairly difficult, challenging process. But I think at the end of the restructuring process, which we hope will be completed by March 2012, we will have a much more effective, efficient, and streamlined organization. So the pain that we are going through now will eventually result, I believe, in a very effective institution. I don't know whether anyone wanted to add to that, Commissioner Mokati.
Thank you. I think just to add on two issues. On the issue of contingent liabilities, I take the point that the CEO has made about the availability of funds. But I think what is what should be noted is that, of course, these were not budgeted for. So the availability of funds means that the funds have been taken from some of the work that the Human Rights Commission would have been doing, that it can no longer do because of these very big sums of money that were never part of the budget. And that is one. And two, on the issue of compliance, not just the compliance with economic and social rights, but we did agree that on the economic and social rights front, what we would have to do would be to continue to request for information from the departments, but we need to be able from our own budget to conduct some pilot projects that we can be, that we will go out and publish and produce reports on, which will be our own initiative. But the multi-pronged strategy to that is something that we have agreed on. And then on compliance with the international treaties, I just want to, by using an example, share with the members of parliament how this actually in reality affects us. Earlier this year, there was in Geneva a call for contributions to the amendments on the optional protocol on communications. We sat down and worked on this, and because we can't ourselves, it had come through international relations. We then produced a report to international relations with very clear recommendations, and we were told that somebody was going to go to Geneva and was going to make sure that they present this, or else they would send the information to Geneva to the representative there to make sure that these are added to for the committee. We had a meeting with all the stakeholders. We met with the Department of International Relations. We met with the Ministry for Women, Children and People with Disabilities. The optional protocol is to the CRC, Convention on the Rights of the Child. We gave all the information. We drafted the reports. At the end of the day, that all those recommendations were not submitted. And we were told that, unfortunately, nobody was able to go to Geneva. But the problem is, how often are we going to be called upon to be able to make those kinds of submissions? It means we have lost an opportunity. This is how, in reality, this affects us.
Commissioner Bai wanted to add, as well as the Deputy Chairperson.
It's not pictured. Thank you very much, President and Members of Parliament. I would like to say that I joined the Commission in January this year, and there are quite a number of things that I would like to raise. There's a question that has been raised behind here in connection with health, that is the death of babies, or if you like, infant and child mortality. I want to say that it is true that we have had a lot of deaths in hospitals in this country, including the Nelson Mandela Hospital, where we lost about 181 newly born babies. Charlotte Mabeke, about 6. And Nelson Mandela Hospital, about 11 babies. The causes of these deaths are regarded as severe diarrhea, inadequate staff, lack of a compressor supplying oxygen to the hospital, norovirus epidemic in neonatal wards, and also overcrowding. In June this year, 5 premature babies died at Jubilee Hospital in Hammanskraal, Pretoria. And also, during the same period, 6 babies died at Charlotte Mabeke Hospital. I want to say to the members of Parliament that there is indeed a high rate of infant mortality in our hospital, and this is indeed very disturbing, to the extent that the Commission has drafted an infant mortality research plan, which Al-Shalu will put in place sometime next month. I thank you.
Thanks very much, Chair. I think the I'd just like to add.
It is on the headline.
Okay, sorry, could you hear me now? I just want to add a little bit on to what my colleagues have already said. I think the engagement with Parliament and our reports to Parliament are an important part of our strategy. In fact, it's not the cornerstone of our strategy to ensure compliance. And I think this committee itself at its last meeting, for example, in relation to PIA, was maybe one of the meetings that you were chairing, the committee itself will take it up and act in relation to non-compliance in terms of the report that we've submitted to this committee for a number of years. And so I suppose that would be very important to hear what has happened since then. Because I think that's a really, and it also relates to the specific questions that were asked in relation to specific non-compliance. The issue of non-compliance in terms of treaty bodies, and I think this committee can play a very valuable and powerful role in supporting the work we've done already in terms of engaging government ministers, engaging the president, etc., on particular treaties. So, for example, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. We've engaged on numerous occasions with government on this matter. It would be really important for this committee to support that and to find out from the executive when is this going to be ratified, when is the protocol going to be signed. The other is in relation to UPR, the Universal Periodic Review. Next year is South Africa's due to appear again, and yet all 22 recommendations made to South Africa are pending, as it's not been indicated if the country accepts or rejects the recommendation. That's another area I think that would be very important for the Universal Periodic Review of the recommendations of the Human Rights Council. So those would be, and we could actually pass that on to you, but those would be very important for this committee to act on. The issue of the culture of secrecy, it's a great concern for us, and it's one which has motivated our submission on this bill already, and the commission has already been engaging with experts at high-level meetings in relation to being able to engage what it is that at this point in time that we've not addressed in our previous submission, that we may still need to address further. I think the specific questions around implementation, around PAIA, the question of the magistrate's court, the questions of penalization, and the question of interdicts and socioeconomic rights, those are very important areas that I think the Commission itself has to engage further, both in terms of resources, but also in terms of this clearer strategy on these matters that has to be agreed on at political level amongst all commissioners and within the Secretariat. The reality is that the Commission has one staff member at what level is?
Deputy
at a Deputy Director level to deal with all of the work that we've done, which has been considerable. So in terms of the areas of what kind of resources we need, how do we highlight that in terms of the budget, this is clearly an area that the Commission is going to have to come back on and motivate clearly why it's important that we have someone at a much more senior level and we have far more substantial support to that individual to ensure that we're able to take forward the kind of strategic intervention that will be powerful in ensuring compliance together with what the committee is going to do in terms of taking things forward. Thanks.
Before you,
yes,
do you still have one or two? There are outstanding matters.
Yes.
Can you address those, please?
Sure. I still have to deal with Honourable John Jeffries, Honourable Swartz, and Honourable Smuts's questions. Some of them have already been touched on, but the vacancy rate for Honourable Jeffrey increased to 14%. That's quite correct. It was quite deliberate, and it's based on the restructuring process. We have postponed the fulfillment of full-time permanent positions until such time as the restructuring process is completed. We've now commissioners have adopted a brand new structure. We've just completed the job evaluation and job grading process, and we are now in the process of implementing that. There's the classification panel that's going to take place very shortly, a placement panel, and then advertising for vacancies that are not filled internally. I should indicate that based on the new structure, we have increased the number of posts from 133 to 176, which is quite a huge jump. We know that we won't be able to fulfill or implement the full structure within the next financial year, given the financial constraints, which I'm also happy to speak to. But what we plan to do is a phased-in approach of all of these additional posts. Most of these posts, you'll note, have been created in the provincial offices, and they focus specifically on providing legal support at the provincial office level. So that's in respect of the vacancy rate. The second question was around attendance of meetings of commissioners. This was a question that was asked in the last portfolio committee meeting, and subsequently we had sent that information to the portfolio committee, but we are happy to do so and provide you with the updated attendance register for commissioners in the next week. The third question related to the contingent liabilities, which I think I've addressed, but if there are any further questions around that.
I mean, on the contingent liabilities, I mean, there's the issue of the Gauteng High Court matter, and then I really don't understand your explanation at all. You're talking about money owed to IDASA as being 1.2 million, but it's reflected as 2.4 million. And then that's different from the 3.333 million for the EU funds, which you sort of joined the two. So I'm actually quite confused about. And then the public works matter is from 5 years ago. Okay, so I you give us a general response about problems of leases,
yeah,
with public works, but this seems to be a very specific issue. So I really don't understand your. You've only given an explanation on IDASA, but the figures are different. And you haven't spoken about the litigation matter in the North Gauteng High Court involving Roberts, okay, and except and what the EU aspect is.
Sure. Maybe I'll just ask Masa to talk to some of those matters, and then I will add to them as well. Go ahead.
Thanks, Ayum. Thanks, Che. Just to clarify, when we classify something as a contingent liability, it's dependent on the happening of certain events. Now, you will see that the total amount that was owed to IDASA was 3.6 million. What the auditors asked us to do was to provide for our portion, all right? So it's three entities. 3.6 million we provided in the liabilities of 1.2 million. Now, the 2.4 remain as a contingent liability. So that's where the different amounts are. And with the
issue of European Union. You'll remember that in the report that was conducted by KPMG, they issued a report to say there is 10 million unaccounted expenditure. Now, because this is an agreement between three entities, we divided the amount of 10 million by three entities. So that's where the 3.3 million come about, because we're sharing the amount equally within the three institutions.
I mean, Chair, look, now it seems as though then the you're already owing. I'm looking at page 111 of your well, it's the Auditor General's report, but it's in yours on page 100. I mean, it's titled 111. It is of your report. So the 1.2 to IDASA, you still owe that, okay? Which is not yet.
Yes, it's the difference between the 3.6.
No, I know.
Yes,
I can work through the math, but it's not here. You owe that.
Yes.
You then put down the 2.4, which you hope somebody else is going to pay.
That's correct. There's Commission on Gender Equality and the Public Protector.
So why does it reflect on your books?
Because it's reflected as a contingent liability. It's contingent upon them paying. The overall...
So you entered the agreement?
All three of us entered the agreement, but this is the way...
Is it on their books too?
It should be. It should be.
Okay, and then what's the 10 million for the EU unaccounted for?
That's the money that's remaining in this bank account which I referred to earlier on. It's money that's going to be transferred back to the EU. So the money has been frozen in the bank account. It's going to be transferred back to them.
So the money is there?
The money is there.
So?
Yes.
So we don't have a problem there?
No, not at all. In fact, I can provide you with the EU report which indicates that there's been absolutely no indication of any wrongdoing on any part. So it's completely above board. It's something we've simply inherited and have just taken a long time to resolve. One of the major challenges with the CSAP, with the EU-funded accounts, is that the signatories had resigned from all three institutions some time back. And it took us quite a while to get new signatories in place, which has now been done. So it's myself and the other two CEOs who are now the new signatories of this account. And we've actually just written to the bank to request the financial statements. The Deputy Minister of Finance has also made available an audit firm, which will be able to audit the financial statements. And the National Treasury is, in fact, paying for that. So the matter is currently being dealt with. It looks worse, I think, than what it is. It has been an ongoing issue for quite a while, but it's really something that we have under control and have been dealing with quite extensively in the last couple of months.
So you only really have the 1.2 million right to worry about?
That's right, yes.
Which is not even reflected. Yes, so of the 8.2 million, you're basically then saying, well, 7.7 million you shouldn't have to pay.
7.7 million, yes. Well, but no. The Department of Public Works...
No, the 7.7... Sorry, the 5.7 million, rather. Sorry, you shouldn't
yes.
have to pay.
Yes.
Hey, add some clarity. The 3.3 million, am I correct in understanding that is going to be transferred back to the EU because we didn't sign an agreement one day in time? Is that it?
That's going to be transferred back to the EU. Yes,
so because they're one day late, they're taking all the money back?
Yes. They've got very strict time frames for their obligations and their contracts, and we discovered this subsequently. So it is going to be transferred back.
So we effectively are paying for what they were going to pay for because we didn't sign something by one day?
No, that money was actually not utilized. The only amount that was utilized was the amount that was paid to, or that was supposed to be paid to IDASA. So that was the main project. Yeah, but the others were just, we couldn't run any of the other projects.
It was in a bank account.
That's right. It's all sitting in the bank account.
Sure.
Yeah.
We should have signed it one day earlier.
I don't know whether you have the answer to that, Martha. It was the three parties, the three former, I suspect the former CEOs of the respective institutions. Yes, this was a few years ago, so I guess the three of them failed to sign.
So not one of them signed, not any of the departments?
From what I understand, yes. Not departments, the commission. Yeah, it's the former, my predecessors, yeah. Maybe what I could do is to assist members of parliament is to provide a much more comprehensive document for you following this meeting, which sets out all of the issues related to the CSAP project and the EDASA matter, and also to provide you with a more current update as to where we are in terms of sorting it out.
If they were supposed to also sign it and they didn't sign it, then why do we have to pay?
No, we're not paying.
No, we're not paying. They're taking their money back, yeah.
Well,
it does is claiming from us.
That's the issue.
Yes.
That's an important one.
Sure.
Because that was supposed to be one of the signatories.
Yes. We have taken a principal position as the three institutions that we can't simply deal with the EU and all of the issues relating to funding. So we've taken the obligation upon ourselves, and as Commissioner McCarthy correctly pointed out, we are using money that would have been allocated to specific projects, which we are now taking away and paying to EDASA. So, unfortunately,
paying to
EDASA? Chair, can I just ask quickly, did EDASA do any work?
Yes, they did. They provided quite a comprehensive analysis and report, yeah.
And was it your responsibility to sign? I mean, keep saying the three didn't sign,
yes.
Including EDASA.
No, not EDASA. When I say the three, it's the CGE, the SAHRC and the Public Protector. Those are the three who did not sign on time.
Okay.
Yeah, we have got a parliamentary link with the EU, but MPs serve on that
body.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
That's a possibility to actually get that document. That means quite regularly at the parliamentary visit.
Yes. Which we can't claim, of course. Yes, which has to be paid back.
Rules are rules. Rules are rules. Ask South African Football Association. Rules are rules.
Do you know about that? Before no fun. Okay, I'll tell you.
Well, okay, you can try. I don't see you succeed. I'm just curious about EDASA. Who's going to speak to EDASA? Why are you speaking to the EU?
We've already spoken to them. In fact, they're quite happy with
you've spoken to them.
Yes, we've already spoken to them. And they're quite happy with the agreement that we've come to. It's just a matter of signing the paperwork.
Which means what?
Which means that we are going to be paying them by the end of October.
Well, that's they would be happy with that.
Sure. The other issue related to compliance with the treaties, which... No?
North Gauteng High Court litigation matters.
Yes. This is simply... money that needed to be paid to the attorneys in this particular matter. Masa, maybe you could possibly just remind me around that. Yeah.
Thanks, Kim, once again. The North Gauteng High Court issue is a matter in which the Human Rights Commission litigated. So the possible outcome of it could be an outflow of $500,000 against the commission, but we could give maybe more details to the case and the progress of that as soon as we get back to the office with the rest of the commission.
Please be aware, we're fully conversant with the details of the case.
Oh,
you need to know that.
Okay.
So don't assume we don't know about it.
No, I'm not.
All right.
Okay.
That's why Mr. Jeffrey is asking.
Can we get your report to see what you say about it?
Sure. When you read the details of the judgment, it's like, wow.
But all right.
Fine, we'll wait for your report.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. The other issue related to compliance with treaties, which has also to some extent been addressed by Commissioner McCarthy, who spoke to some of the significant challenges we've been experiencing in ensuring that government departments fulfill their obligation in respect of these treaties. I know with respect to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, the last time the South African government submitted a report was in 2005. And the Charter obliges us to submit reports every 2 years. We raised this directly with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development at a workshop we facilitated at Wits University. And the response, unfortunately, from the Chief Director who was present at that meeting was really not very effective at all. He simply blamed the Department of International Relations, who was blaming the Department of Justice. Excuse me. So the
to assist, I think both Commissioner Mokate and Deputy Chair Commissioner Govender dealt with the issue. So I don't know if Mr. Ahmed, Ahmed needs to say anything more.
Sure.
But what I would want to say is the point, particularly that and because it's just becoming a bit anecdotal. What would be useful is the points, particularly that Commissioner Govender had raised, that we need that in writing. She came up with a list, which I thought was very useful. We need that in writing. But then, on what I think we also need, because the department is coming here on Thursday, we would need by Wednesday, tomorrow, a list of the issues involving the department where they have not complied with their international of reporting obligations. We can actually take that up with them to respond to on Thursday.
Thank you very much. Moving on to Honorable Swart. The first question related to the risk management officer, whether that person has been appointed. No, that person has not been appointed, but what we've decided to do is, with the restructuring process, we've ensured that the chief financial officer position has a risk management component to it. We've tabled this with our audit committee, and they are happy with the approach that we've adopted. Instead of creating a brand new post focusing specifically on risk management, in the interim, our internal audit unit has been managing managing risk through various tools that they've been using. So there are interim measures in place, and then the CFO, once he or she is appointed, will take over that responsibility. The second question related to the material misstatement, which I made reference to in my report, that specifically relates to the CSAP and the Department of Public Works issues. It was, as I indicated, stated as a contingent liability, and that was subsequently reflected by the AG as a provision. So those are the issues that were taken into account. So those misstatements have been corrected. The Eastern Cape baby's death matter, I think that Commissioner Bai had responded to that matter, so I won't deal with that. And then the fourth question related to page 115 of the report, which made reference to the high number of cases in the Western Cape versus Gauteng. The cases in the Gauteng office is a relatively new office. It used to be, all the cases in Gauteng used to be run by head office, and the transfer of cases between head office and Gauteng still needs to be finalized, and this is one of the reasons why Gauteng may appear less than the Western Cape. You'll notice that the total number of cases in Gauteng at the moment is 926, whereas in the Western Cape it's 1,751. The Western Cape office is simply a more established office, and this is precisely why they receive more complaints. It was the first provincial office that was in fact set up outside of Gauteng. But the Western Cape has consistently received just slightly more complaints than the Gauteng officer, but those two are our biggest officers. The other question related to the compliance-driven approach, which I made reference to, and this specifically, again, the question was around what do we do around the compliance-driven approach, what can we possibly do as an institution. For that question, I think commissioners would probably be best to respond to that. Safe to say that, again, we bring this information to the portfolio committee and hope that the portfolio committee will assist us with ensuring that this we move from a compliance-driven approach to a substantive engagement around human rights issues. But other than that, I think direct engagement with government departments at various levels will ensure that this approach is substantively changed. But perhaps commissioners could add to that response as well. Then the use of interdicts to enforce socio-economic rights is an interesting concept. We have, as far as I'm aware, not utilized this approach before, but it's certainly something we could consider. I don't know the details, unfortunately. I haven't read the article that you were referring to, but it's certainly something that we could look into and perhaps provide you with some responses to once we've done that. Sure. We can. Thank you very much. Thank you. thanks very much for that. The other question was around the Mail and Guardian case relating to Paia and the culture of secrecy. Again, I think I will defer to the Deputy Chairperson to possibly assist in responding to that, as well as some of the other commissioners. Oh, she has, yes, of course she has touched on that as well. And then there were specific matters, I'm just trying to remember. Oh, yes, the dignity complaints. The complaints relate overwhelmingly to people being referred to in derogatory terms. So language being used which is inappropriate and so on, and this is where the dignity issue comes in. Some of the major cases we've dealt with related to dignity are in fact the toilets cases where human dignity was violated, and this is something that we've noticed as a particular challenge both in the Free State and in the Western Cape. Of course various measures have been taken to address those matters relatively effectively. The other question was around the effectiveness of the equality courts. We have a preliminary report which has not been made available yet, but the indication is that unfortunately the equality courts are not being used effectively by the public. I don't think that this came as a surprise to anyone, but there is a lack of understanding both at the court level itself of magistrates not understanding the legislation, as well as at a general community level, people not understanding their ability to access these courts.
Maybe this is very important for us, the committee, especially now that we're going to look at all the courts in the country. Could we ask, it's preliminary, it doesn't matter, it's not the people, but just to enrich our thinking, would you be happy to give us something?
Sure, we can provide it.
Yeah.
Yes. So certainly we would be happy to provide you with a preliminary, the copy of the preliminary report as well as the final report once it's been done. I can certainly make that available. The other question was around how we were using Parliament around the Office for Institutions Supporting Democracy. I think we've also touched on that. We have also, Commissioner Mokati had touched on the engagement with the various departments as well as the president. And then the last question, if I remember correctly, was around the newest version of the Protection of Information Bill and how we will be engaging with this particular bill. I'm going to defer to Commissioner, the Deputy Chairperson, on this particular matter, but to indicate that we've, of course, already made a number of submissions, which I'm sure you've seen, and we are continuously engaging with the latest versions of the document. I know that commissioners had a meeting which they convened of a panel of experts around this bill to provide them with further guidance and information and to try and get a diverse range of perspectives on the bill. So perhaps commissioners could touch on that. So that was Honourable Swart's questions. And then lastly, turning to Honourable Smuts. Okay. Oh, yes. Oh, okay. My apologies. No. Okay, then I think we've covered. There was one last question which I haven't dealt with. The one around the mineral resources in that table that you referred to, Honourable Smuts, and how do we, defining the Section 32D issue. Unfortunately, I don't have a direct response for you now, but this is something that we could get back to you on. My apologies for that, but yeah, we can respond to you in writing around that question.
I think on most of the others I've already touched on. I think just to the question of the issue of the conceptual misunderstanding around socioeconomic rights and how would we deal with that. I think one is obviously the one that we've already spoken about, which is came around to you as this committee and to Parliament, and for Parliament to actually engage the executive and the administration around how they understand it. The other is in terms of how we are engaging particular issues and rights that we are taking up. So for example, and I want to return to the example that I've given earlier of the issue of the toilets, that we deal with it. There's a danger that if we dealt with the right to sanitation alone, without actually understanding and without creating the understanding or supporting and strengthening the understanding that rights are indivisible and equal and universal, that there can be a pitting against one right against the other right in terms of resources, in terms of particularly in terms of resources. So that what we, the way in which we've been dealing with it is to actually emphasize that, that in fact that you cannot have the integrated nature, the interdependent nature of depriving the right of sanitation to a whole range of other rights, whether that's health or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the other is in terms of saying that we're not dealing with these cases as individual cases of individual municipalities alone, that we deal with it in terms of how does government as a whole, not just as separated spheres of government, but government as a whole is responsible for ensuring socioeconomic rights, for delivery of socioeconomic rights. And therefore it has to have a plan, it has to have a very clear assessment. So in relation to the specific right to sanitation, we've asked that they must have a clear assessment of what is happening with that right throughout the country. The next step is, what is their plan to address that right? What is the resources that they will put to that right? But not as an isolated right in relation to all other socioeconomic rights, in relation to all rights. So I think that's something that, in terms of our ongoing engagement on every single issue, whether it's in relation to education and the child equity in child rights, all of those things, the way in which we engage every single issue has been to try to emphasize the integrated nature of rights and the interdependent nature of rights. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Honorable Smuts raised an issue about education, and she said, so what do we do? Because whilst we are aware that we have a near universal registration or entrance, I don't know what to call it, because it's not really the thing that we are looking for. So how do we deal with this? Honorable Smart, on the 24th of June, I addressed members of all the legislatures, all the nine provinces at the Speaker's Forum, and just sharing really the fact that basic education is a guaranteed right in our constitution, and the responsibility at provincial level towards basic education, and I had some information for them in terms of where we rank as a country, you know, and just to bring closer home what is happening in the area of basic education. Because I think that is where we need to be working now, as opposed to maybe at just national level. We need to work with it. In my presentation, I have a thing that shows where each and every province stands in terms of performance. So the other important issue here is to remind the provincial legislatures as well about their responsibility in terms of this right. So this is going to continue. I'm hoping that the CEO will have money for me, because I would like to be able to continue to work with them on this issue, because it's a very critical issue, and I think that's the level at which we can appeal to at this point.
That in terms of how we're using Parliament, and I think that the issue of the Commission's attempted to engage government around the upcoming COP17, and there has been very little positive response to that, and I think that is an area that the issue of from government in terms of writing to government to actually ensure that the issues around because actually looking at the human rights perspective on the matters of climate change is a critical one. And I think it would be an important one to ensure that there's support for that engagement. Thanks, Jim.
Chair, one last matter. I completely forgot about the question that Honorable Jeffrey asked in relation to the finances of the Commission. This is the presentation that we made about a month ago to National Treasury requesting additional funding. I neglected to include this in the pack that was distributed to Vonani, but I'm happy to make this available. So this is ideally what we would require, an additional 30 million. And you'll see it also covers some of the outstanding debts, the DPW and the CSAP issues, as well as the various other matters that we are looking at. The overwhelming majority, of course, of costs relate to the new posts that have been created in the institution, which is essential for us to fulfill our mandate, particularly the mandate relating to legal services and dealing with complaints. So this is just a very rough overview of the additional money required, but I'm happy to make this available to members of Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
I really don't think that's particularly satisfactory at all, in that... And in fact, I find it fairly insulting. Basically, there's a budget review process that we embark on, where we all the committees sit with the departments and hear from them what their additional needs are. You can't just, if you're not taking it seriously, the process, and you're not respecting us through that. To just simply say, okay, well, I forgot it this time, should have done it, sorry, but what I'll actually just send you is what we handed to Treasury. I mean, that's just not taking it seriously at all, and that's fine, but then don't moan about having shortage of funds, because we're not going to ask for any more money for you if you haven't got the, if you won't follow the correct procedures in terms of making representations to us about the areas you need further money. Because really what I'm saying is, all you're saying is oh, okay, you know, we'll just give you what we gave Treasury.
Sure.
So I don't think that is adequate, Chair, at all.
As I understood the presenter, you said you made the submission to us at your last appearance. So it's not?
No, you made it to
Treasury. So this is the first time we've seen it.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, what I was under the impression that this specific meeting focused on the annual report and not on the submissions that we made to Treasury or requests for additional information. I think that may have been
an oversight. Mr. Ahmed, you were here last year. I mean,
yes.
This is the second year.
Yes.
At this time of year, you do the annual report and we do the budget review process. You should know that coming from Parliament.
Yeah, every year this time of the year there's a budget review process. So, all right. I had assumed they didn't need any more money.
Yes, well, I think they don't. They're not here.
I think Chair, and I think the Honourable JJ, I think the CEO has adequately explained and apologised for the oversight. It's an important one. And I think that definitely, I think it's the Commission respects the role of this committee in relation to the budget process.
Yeah.
And actually, as in the other mandates of this committee, looks to it to be able to support the work of the Commission, to ensure that the Commission fulfills its constitutional mandate. So I think that we completely accept what you are saying, and we hope that it will actually be taken forward by the committee. Thanks very much.
Yeah, we've got nothing to take forward.
Chairman,
there's a general thing of oh, they need more money, but we, you know, with the other bodies, they will say we want more money for X and Y. We've been to Treasury. This is what we've got from Treasury, but we now need more money for X and Y. We've got nothing from the Human Rights Commission.
Chair, we now have something before us.
What?
Let's be mature. We've got that in front of us that's now been given to us.
No,
but let's just take us back in the process.
Yeah,
when
that will be given to us, that is what
Treasury. Can I just continue, Jim? That is now before us. Whether you like it or not, it is before us. But when we had the budgetary process at the beginning of this year, we were fully informed about the financial constraints of the Human Rights Commission in great detail. So surely that must be read in conjunction. And yes, maybe there was a slip-up in this regard, a misunderstanding. But let's be sensitive to the needs of the Commission as well, and let's apply our minds to their needs and not just write it off. I appreciate that we can feel insulted or what, but let's be mature about it and say that we know the Commission has severe financial constraints. And as opposed to just leaving it as it is, let's look how we can assist the Commission. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's correct, Mr. Swart. I fail to see how putting something on a screen, which is not in front of us, well, it is in front of us on the screen, but you can't say that is before us. And that's a document that they presented to Treasury. So I don't know why you're being so apologetic for them, but I just don't think it's acceptable. And Chair, factually, that's not before us. They may want to make later submissions. That's up to them.
All right. Can we ask you this?
Sure.
You made this submission to Treasury.
Yeah.
Have you received a response from Treasury? And if so, what was their response?
No, we've not received a response from Treasury. But that's one of the ways we could address this this situation, is for us to provide and submit a detailed report to the Portfolio Committee, and not simply, as Honourable JJ had indicated, submit this document to the Portfolio Committee. We will.
You were saying, Chair's correction, you were saying you would just submit this
exactly
document to us. So it's not what I was saying, and my surname is Jeffrey, not my nickname, if you can, you know,
My apologies.
I was not saying submit what you said submit to Treasury.
Yes.
The difficulty, Chair, with that is I really don't know what one does with a document that they have not, you know, that they're not here for, that one then just has to look at.
Okay.
Let's ask them to make a detailed submission based on what is on this screen.
Thanks, Chair. We would welcome that, the opportunity to do a detailed
submission. The point being made by Mr. Jeffrey is that, and understandably, is that this comes as an afterthought. You see, whereas Mr. Swart makes the point that earlier in the year you did point out the serious constraints you were facing, and we accepted that, and we thought that right at the beginning of this meeting that would be in front of us.
Sure.
But it's not. And as you went along, I assumed, as I'm sure others did, that, okay, then you don't have a problem. It does say you owe 1.2 million, you're going to pay it, and so on. And then suddenly now, out of the blue, is this. And so you need to understand.
May I have a chance, please?
Well, if the Chair is speaking, will you respect his right to also speak?
Chair, I thought you'd
finished. I didn't see your hand being raised.
It's been raised.
You want? No,
it's
no, I didn't. So please, can I be allowed to finish without interruption? Thank you. Now, Mr. CEO and Triggs, you wanted to say something. This is your opportunity.
Thanks very much, Chair, and thanks to the Honourable Jeffrey for the to the Honourable Swart. To the discussion that we've just had, I think that we would most welcome the opportunity to present substantive input on the question of the budget. The Commission was invited to this meeting a week ago, so we had a week in which to actually ensure that we had a substantial presentation done. And this is the annual report and the first quarterly report. And we definitely take it very seriously around the issue of the budget. It's something that we did raise in our meeting earlier this year. We certainly would like the opportunity to engage the Commission in a substantive way around this. And so we'd like to take forward the proposal you're making, Chair. Thanks very much.
No. All right. I have overlooked Advocate Holomisa for some time. Please.
Yes, thank you. The task gets to be settled a little bit. Chair, the question I'm asking has been somewhat touched upon. It relates to the non-ratification of some of the treaties. And the suggestion has been made by Honorable Jeffrey that a list of these must be given to us by tomorrow so that we can engage the Department of Justice. But the Deputy Chairperson has mentioned that they have even spoken to the president. I don't know whether it was verbally or through the communication or through letters and things like that. But I was keen to know as to what has been the response then of the president. I hear the incident about a workshop in which an official couldn't give a definitive explanation of what was happening. But I will be keen either today or maybe as part of that report they will be giving us when we are preparing to engage the department as to what was the president's response to that. And on the other matter, it's a question that has always arisen here about the law in terms of which the commission operates. It is a 1994 Act, and I know that there is the Carter Azmal report that is still lying somewhere here in Parliament. But nonetheless, as the Commission itself, have they not considered drafting a piece of legislation that should be considered by the Department of Justice for submission to this committee so that it can be considered? Where does that lie? Is it still with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development? What are they as the Commission are doing to ensure that the act that gives life to them is in line with the Constitution? And lastly, the languages used to raise complaints have been indicated, and I noticed that the Xitsonga, Xivenda, and Sindebele, no complaints have been raised in those languages. What does that mean in the understanding of the Commission? Is it reflective of the satisfaction on the part of those languages that they are with the human rights that they are enjoying? Are they satisfied to the extent they don't have any reason to complain? Or could it be they are complaining in some other language? Or could it be that they are not aware of the rights that are being violated and things like that? Have they applied their minds to establish as to why is that the case when other languages are complaining and yet they do not? Thank you, sir.
Honourable Debbie Schaefer, followed by the Honourable John Jeffrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just first wanted to say it was never my understanding that this was part of the budget review, and my recollection from last year is that it was actually a separate process. So in support of the Human Rights Commission, I can understand that if they're confused. My second point is I just wanted to follow up on the issue. I don't think we had an answer about whether there is, in fact, a criminal sanction in the Act. And if there is, why does the Human Rights Commission either not lay criminal charges themselves in respect of non-compliance with PIA or advise the complainants to do so? Thanks.
I'm not sure where Ms. Schaefer was. I mean, I remember having to chair the meeting last year. We did both the annual report and we did the budget review. Christina's in agreement. Maybe you could check your records, Ms. Schaefer. Look, mine is unfortunately now we've lost that document that was on the screen, and the one that is not before us. But I see that you know this. It to me it's extremely confusing. I mean that the public works program is there now. It's 2.8 million. What we were getting briefed on before was about an amount of about I think was 600,000. So it really seems to me to be a little bit all over the place. I see that's where the ADASA figures ended up. But anyway, let's look at the document. But I'm just disappointed that you know, particularly because the relationship between the Commission and Parliament is close, particularly in terms of the CEO coming from Parliament, that I would have thought there would have been an understanding of the budget review process. It is new. If it was some other body, you could understand it. And then I think as far as maybe the notice was late, but I mean, this happens every year. So it's not as if it should have been what should have been an issue would have been the actual date the presentation had to be made, rather than a problem of not being prepared. And anyway, it's just on your annual report and a quarterly report, which is there already. But on Nkosi Hulamisa's point, I think it's something that the researchers point out in our report, that the complaints form is only in English and Afrikaans. Is that correct? And if so, how can that be correct? And is that not part of the answer to his question, not the full answer, but really how can you, so many years on, leave out the other 9 official languages and then expect, then be surprised? I wanted to notice, linked to that, community development workers. Do you have any relationship with them? I mean, particularly when it comes to complaints issues. And have you considered running briefing workshops? Because they're really, I think, the government officials closest to the ground. And are they actually aware of the Human Rights Commission, the processes, so that in their work they can form a channel between people on the ground and yourselves? Then, Chedis, lastly, on the access to PIA matters, I'm a bit disappointed with the response on the magistrates' courts, because, Chair, yesterday, through dealing with the access protection of personal information bill, I mean, the PIA, an important leg of PIA is the use of the magistrates' courts to adjudicate disputes. And we've been asking at that technical committee ourselves the question, why the magistrates' court's not being used. Now, the rules only came into effect in November last year, but we've then since discovered yesterday, and it was our researchers, Ms. Silkstone, who discovered it, is basically, well, the magistrates have to be trained, and they haven't been trained. And there's a whole lot of blockages that are happening at that level. It's something, Chair, I think, as this committee we need to get to grips with. And PIA will be passing from the Human Rights Commission to the Information Regulator. But it's just disappointing that the Commission couldn't pick this up. That there's aside from ticking the boxes, there was actually a blockage in the system. Now, maybe if they've only got one person, they were too busy, but it's just, that was disappointing. And then, just on the this is now pointing the finger the other way, on your non-Section 32 compliance, Chair, it's on page 166 of the report. Halfway down the list of the national bodies, under P is Parliament. Okay, as being non-compliant. And then under the provincial departments, Limpopo is 100% compliant, but every other province, with the exception of Mpumalanga, the provincial legislatures are not compliant. So it's Eastern Cape, Free State, down to Western Cape. I find it a bit ironic, actually, in the narrative of the report, they praise the Western Cape for its compliance, and then talk about the important role that the City of Cape Town, which got the Golden Spoon Award, or Key Award rather, and the it's page 100, it's page 151. Close to 100% compliance has been reached by the Western Cape province in this cycle. High compliance rates in this province are attributable to the commitment by the Western Cape Legislature, Office of the Premier, and the City of Cape Town. What's just ironic is the Western Cape Legislature, according to your list, is non-compliant. So they might have been active helping you, but they didn't get themselves together. But, Chair, the point I'm really trying to make is what... How has the Commission? I mean, I think that's worrying. That's problematic. It's problematic for us as Parliament. But has the Commission engaged Parliament? When Commissioner Mokate went on the, I mean, I know her area is something else. It is socio-economic rights. Mm-hmm. But to the Speaker's Forum, was this issue ever addressed? Have there been attempts to engage the Speaker's Forum? Because that seems to be the place that should be engaged.
Thank you. When I appeared before the speakers forum, I actually tried to engage the speakers on all areas of concerns, including this issue.
Yes.
Yes, thank you.
Chairperson, if I may start off by responding to Advocate Olomisa. The non-ratification of treaties, I think, had to some extent been dealt with already, but we will, as I indicated, be providing members of Parliament with further information around that particular matter, given that you are meeting with the Department of Justice in, 2 days from now. The Kada Asmo report and the legislation that was drafted, clearly the Commission had made several submissions around the Asmo report and had also, in fact, provided the Department of Justice with new legislation, the Human Rights Commission Act amendments, which incorporate some of the recommendations made in the Asmo report, and that was submitted as currently with the Department of Justice as well. And I understand that that's where it is, and that following that it will be brought to Parliament, but substantive inputs have been made in that regard. The issue around languages, which is also raised by Honourable Jeffrey, is a major concern for us. You are quite correct when you say that the complaints forms are still in English and Afrikaans, and what happens is that the provincial managers or the legal officers who engage and interact with those complainants then translate the language that the complainant speaks in into English or Afrikaans. That is clearly unacceptable. It is one of the issues that we are addressing, and in fact has been addressed in the new complaint handling manual that's just been adopted. And one of the annexures to the manual are complaints forms in every language. So that's something that's, that has subsequently been addressed. And that may be one of the reasons why in the statistics a number of the English and Afrikaans complainants seem to be higher than all of the other languages. It's partly because of the complaints forms. The question asked then by Honourable Jeffrey around the community development workers is in fact something that we have been engaging with them, particularly around the advocacy work that we do. We have had training of trainers which involves community development workers in various provincial offices, and that work has been quite substantive. The PAIA matters, I hear what you're saying about the Magistrates Court's response and the response not being adequate. Unfortunately, I don't have all of that information with me around the use of the Magistrates Court and the work that's been done by the Commission around that. But again, I will be happy to provide you with that information once I engage with my colleagues at the head office.
Yes. Sorry, there is no information. The Magistrates Courts are not being used. That's the bottom line. That's what was surprising, is that the Human Rights Commission didn't pick that up.
Okay. Noted. They aren't working. The other issue was around the budget, which, and I want to apologize and take full responsibility for this oversight. I think that the focus was on the annual report and the first quarter report and not so much on the finances. I know if there is time available, I would be happy to do a full presentation on the budget. I'm prepared to do that right now and have all of the information at my disposal. So if there's time, I'm happy to do so. Alternatively, we can forward a more comprehensive report to the portfolio committee. But simply to indicate that I'm sincerely apologetic for that oversight. We had thought that this was specifically to deal with the annual report. Thank you, Chairperson.
I seem to recall Craig's Advocate Holomisa's question was, if you engaged with the President or the Presidency, was there a response, and if so, are you able to give us that response?
Unfortunately, the person who represented the Commission in that meeting, on the basis of the discussion that the Commission has had, which included this issue, is the chairperson of the Commission. And he's out of the country right now at a meeting, and we could attempt to get that information, but I suspect it might be difficult. But we could try. We certainly could try to find out, because we haven't yet received, we don't have a full written report from the chair on the meeting that he had with the President on behalf of the Commission.
All right. And then the next issue is, honourable members, given what Christine has discovered about the magistrates' courts, is this not an opportunity? You see, I'm thinking of your information regulator. I don't see that office coming into being immediately the law is signed by the President. It's going to take a while. And that being the case, do we simply sit back and say, oh, well, we'll wait for the Information Regulator's Office to come about? Should we not engage with the Magistrates Commission, for example? Just a thought, as a committee and as a commission on this matter. I just put it to you as a thought.
Yeah, I wanted to actually, and maybe, I mean, Ms. Smuts is also part of that technical committee, and I know you went to the presentations of the Golden Key Awards, but maybe to discuss it informally first and then discuss proposals rather than try and do it formally in this meeting.
Right. You can respond if you want to, but he wants an informal chat first. Okay, fine. All right. What else?
I want to keep bashing, but I look, I mean, the language of the language issue, and I mean, you've accepted it's incorrect, but the problem is it's I mean, my Afrikaans is not that good, but I would be able to translate with a dictionary probably a complaint form from English into Afrikaans. It doesn't need to be done because that's the other language that you've got. I'm really surprised that nobody could translate this form into any of the other nine languages. And to some extent it's an indication of and it may be the issue linked to the points Nkosi Holomisa is raising, is it an indication of attitude to those languages? You know, because it's blatantly obvious. You need the form so that it's accessible, that people can read it. And you don't have to go to some university qualified translator. You can go to a person in that language, ask them whose home language is that language, ask them to translate it, maybe get it checked out by a couple of other people who speak the same language, and it's simple. So it's worrying in that it's an indication of, is the Commission not interested in complaints? I know you are, okay, but it's just that indication, and I do think it needs to be attended to urgently, and I don't think it needs to be a costly business. It's something that your own staff members can do.
I think the issue of language is a critical one that the Commission does recognize and does respect, and that's been a critical thing in relation to the changing of the complaints manual and the forms, etc. But I think the fact that the person who in the office writes the form in English or in Afrikaans doesn't mean necessarily that the person who is the complainant is speaking in English or Afrikaans. The person who is often speaking to the legal officer often speaks in the language of their choice, which is not reflected necessarily in the form, because the form is written, has that a very problematic limitation. So I think that issue of the form has been addressed, but definitely in terms of the practice within the Commission, in terms of different areas of the country, in terms of provincial offices, there has been a practice where people do translate what the complaint is into the language of the form. So definitely it hasn't been, Honourable Olamisa, that there hasn't been complaints from particular language groups. It hasn't, that is not the case. I think it's just simply been an issue, a limitation, and a serious limitation of the way the forms have been in the past, which has been rectified. So I think that we'll see both, not just the the legal officer translating the complaint into English or into Afrikaans or any form, but in being able to actually write it in the language in which it has been accepted. Thanks very much.
Chairperson, one last question from me. It's a question I always wish I would not have to ask, that I would simply find the answer in the report. The question of how organizations dealing with human rights issues, therefore, concerned more with the underprivileged and underdeveloped communities. How do you relate with the traditional councils and maybe even the houses of traditional leaders when you go about advocating the culture of human rights? Because these are the people who are more vulnerable than any other. Or could it be, I hear that you've had workshops with CDWs, but there are in those villages also other officials associated with traditional councils. Do you have any relations with those that kind of institution, so that the people who rely on those institutions can benefit from the work that the commission is doing? And in this report, I haven't seen any indication that there's been any interaction with those people. Or could it be that some people view traditional councils or the institution of traditional leadership as one of the culprits in the violation of people's human rights, that the commission may not be having any relations with these structures? Thank you, Chair.
Commissioner.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I just want to assure Honorable Olomisa that, in fact, in every workshop that the Commission has, traditional leaders are part of it. Every workshop. But there have been special workshops that the Commission, for instance, on economic and social rights, which have been directed at traditional leaders, because there were concerns about the implementation of economic and social rights in those in the communal areas and what happens there. There's been, for instance, all these issues around Ubutwala have been dealt with traditional leaders. The issue of issues around the circumcision and all those issues have been dealt with. And the reports, I think what we need to do actually is to circulate some of those reports, CEO, that have been done on the issues pertaining to what is happening in communal areas. Thanks.
Maybe just to take a lead from JJ, is there any reference to those kinds of interactions here?
They are covered generally, Chairperson, through you in the reports on advocacy. But I must also indicate that the CRL Rights Commission is the primary body that engages with these traditional councils. We usually work through them to engage with the House of Traditional Leaders, and this is why there's not a specific focus on these constituencies in our report, but it is reflected in the statistics at least, which is covered in the advocacy and outreach interventions.
Yes, it would help. Yeah. All right. Honourable members, it looks like we've... All right.
Discriminatory to invite the Honourable Jeffrey to the Golden Spoon Award and not the rest of the Commission.
He called it the Golden Spoon Award, not the Wooden Spoon.
I wasn't invited this year. You were. I was invited last year in
my capacity as chairing that technical committee on the protection of personal information bill. So maybe if Ms. Schaefer wants to chair that technical committee, she could then be invited next year.
We're being handed a document now, but it's not actually what we're looking for. What we're looking for is the presidency's response to this, okay? All right. Honourable members?
That was short. Yeah, short.
Okay. I was just going to say, all right, Betsy. It's for me to say thank you to all of you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Briggs. Please get well quickly.
I'm well.
No, you're not. No, you're not. If you're in a wheelchair, you can't be well.
One part of you is not well
is the leg.
As the Commission, we uphold the rights of people with temporary and permanent disabilities.
Well, that's another matter. I'm just saying get well. You're insisting that you are well. Okay. All right. CEO, Commissioners, thank you very much for your presence and your submissions today. It's been interesting. And we look forward to your further submissions. Both on the additional funding that you requested and your comments on the protection of state information bill, current, not the original bill. A lot of people are still reading the original bill, amongst others. So we really look forward to that. To everyone else, our thanks and appreciation.
But that doesn't happen too often.
Okay. So you're done for today.
I'm done for today. I went to another one yesterday, and I've got a sneaky feeling I will be sent to the Thursday.
Okay.
But then, like, this period is
right.
Extremely, it's the most busiest period So I'm guessing I'll go to a third meeting.
Tomorrow?
No, Thursday.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And how long does it take you to transcribe?
To transcribe this all. Well...